Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Good evening, and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
So today we'll take a look at a Spanish Muslim. And I've been meaning to take another look at Muslim Spain because there's a lot of really, really interesting characters there. So I think we've done one before, which is Ramon Llull. This is the second one. He's a little bit before his time. Today we're going to look at Maslama al-Majiti, or, and pardon if I don't pronounce this 100% correct, but Abu al-Qasim al-Qurtubi al-Majiti. And he also had a Latin moniker, which was Metilim. So he died in 1008 or 1007. And so he was a Muslim astronomer, chemist, mathematician, economist, which I think is really interesting, actually. I'll talk about that. And also scholar in Islamic Spain. And I would actually go with chemist rather than alchemist here, which I think he had some pretty strong viewpoints that are really interesting, way ahead of his time in some ways.
And Travis, this is important to think too. In Moorish Spain at the time brought a lot of what we know today into Europe as that knowledge base from the Middle East.
That was a big, right? Yeah, even old Greek writings and everything. That was one of the two big sources, the other one being Constantinople, or the fall of Constantinople. So he did a lot of really cool things, but some of them were, he took part in the translation of Ptolemy's Planisphereum. He improved existing translation of the Almagest. He improved astronomical tables of Al-Khwarizmi. Another cool thing that I think is really interesting is that he helped historians by working out tables to convert Persian dates into the Hijri year, which is, you know, the Islamic calendar. He also introduced techniques of surveying and triangulation, which is, you know, pretty cool and involves geometry. And so this was during the reign of Al-Hakam II. According to Sa'id ibn Ahmad Andalusi, he was the best mathematician and astronomer of his time, at least in Al-Andalus. Another contemporary of his was Ibn al-Safar, which, you know, regarding like surveying methods and that kind of thing, is really, really famous. He wrote a book on the taxation and economy of Al-Andalus, which I think is one of his interesting things.
He also edited and made changes to parts of the Encyclopedia of Brethren of Sincerity when the encyclopedia arrived in Andalus.
Another really interesting thing, again, I keep saying that, but I think a lot of the things he did is really fascinating. He predicted a futuristic process of kind of scientific interchange, like, you know, he kind of envisioned a network of scientific communication, and which we now have, so that's kind of cool. And he built a school of astronomy, mathematics, and even his take on mathematics is really interesting, which we'll get to. I know I keep saying that, but
we're going to get there.
There's a lot of really interesting stuff about this guy. His school really marked the beginning of kind of organized scientific research in Al-Andalus. One of those students was Al-Safar that we mentioned before, but also Abu al-Salt and Al-Tartushi, all people that you could look up and are very interesting in their own rights. I'm going to say it one more time. Another really interesting thing he did, which, because I'm a big fan of Lavoisier and the whole chemical kind of revolution that happened that changed alchemy to chemistry, and one of those was the conservation of mass, which Lavoisier was one of the main players of that some 700 years later, 800 years later almost. But he actually had kind of a theory. There's one of his books that he wrote was the Rutbat al-Hakim, which, among other things, described formula and procedures for the purification of precious metals. In that book, he attempts to show that there is some sort of principle of mass conservation. Okay, and, you know, again, 8 centuries later, Lavoisier would get credit for this. So, you know, I don't know if he clearly wasn't very formal as the ones in the 18th, 19th century. The exact details of his theory or why he thought that are lost, unfortunately, now. but and his experimentation on Mercury proved that he was at least cognizant of this almost non-existent change in the weight of mass after the reaction. So, you know, that's all conservation of mass is, that you have two inputs and or whatever, however many inputs and however many outputs, but they weigh the same. And then later we would even say it on an atomic level, you know, so that he was aware that you're not creating more when you through a chemical reaction, or you're not losing anything. Somehow, even though you might have different compositions, you have the same mass. So you have the same quantity of inputs and outputs. So that's like, I can't overemphasize that. That is really huge. And, you know, again, 800 years before it was officially, you know, documented and kind of spread.
Well, Travis, as we opened up the show tonight, you really put emphasis on the idea that he was a chemist. And this really, really puts a spotlight on
Yeah, this is one of those things where I think this really separates him from the hoi polloi of, like, you know, your average alchemists and people that didn't really understand those kind of principles. So he clearly understood that, no, I'm taking something and I have a result, and I'm not magically creating something in between or losing something. Like, no, it's the same ingredients, they just look different now. So that's really a big difference.
And unfortunately, we lost some of this work, of course, and when you lose some track in a historical figure, sometimes things get a little murky, especially in this show that we talk about with alchemy. We have a lot of pseudo biographies that we talk about, and this is not far from that. Pseudo al-Majriti is one of these perfect example of this. From the date of his death, inconsistencies result in the dating of two of these influential works in early chemistry that are attributed to him, as either they were either published long after his death, or they were some work of somebody else, like another pseudo, claiming some of his glory. This is something that's happened time and time again when we're talking about alchemists. The latter is the current general belief.
Yeah, it seems like most things I've come across kind of agree that it's just somebody else signing the work in his name. And, you know, we've obviously dealt with this a half dozen times, like Pseudo-Democritus, Pseudo-Thomas Aquinas. You know, there's all kinds of times we've dealt with this, but not everybody agrees. I've also read that, for instance, the Rubat al-Hakim was published in 1009, which is only like 1 or 2 years after his death. So it could have been that his student published it, but still used his name. You know, maybe, who knows how much editing went on, but it's, you know, I wouldn't say that's the only theory, that it was somebody else claiming to be him. It could have been that he had a manuscript laying around, and so it was published after his death, but it was written by him. But some other works attributed to him were written much after his death. So, okay, you know, there might be a little bit of both, depending on what we're talking about. There's the other famous book that he's known for is the Gayat al-Hakim. Both the Rubat al-Hakim and Gayat al-Hakim were both translated into Latin. The Gayat al-Hakim was kind of changed in 1252 on the orders of King Alfonso X of Castile, kind of adding some Christian dogma to it, or editing it in some way that was kind of, you know, fit the palates of the Catholic conquerors then later. But
there must have been something that the church had seen as very important in these writings, that they would spend the time to translate it into Latin.
Yep, and you know, it is also noteworthy that this happened well before the reconquest of Spain, like 200 years before. So it is, or 250 years. So yeah, it was actually deemed important enough to you know, seek this out and translate it, not just later when they conquered Cordoba or whatever. So it's pretty interesting stuff. Yeah, another thing he's known for was his experiment on mercury oxide, or mercuric oxide, which, again, you know, this comes back to the conservation of mass when we mentioned that it was these experimentations that were really groundbreaking in the assumptions that it doesn't lose or gain mass. There's a quote I found from him. So the quote is, "I took natural quivering mercury, free from impurity, and placed it in a glass vessel shaped like an egg. This I put inside another vessel, like a cooking pot, and set the whole apparatus over an extremely gentle fire." This should sound familiar to us by now, by the way. "The outer pot was then in such a degree of heat that I could bear my hand upon it. I heated the apparatus day and night for 40 days, after which I opened it. I found the mercury, the original weight of which was 1/4 pound, had been completely converted into red powder, soft to the touch, the weight remaining as it was originally." So really, kind of, so it completely oxidized, but it's still the same weight as it was originally.
Conservation of mass.
Yep. And I found another quote that said it was 4 days, not 40. From alchemical recipes, clearly 40 is more along the lines of the time periods we're talking about. But I found another one that's four, so I don't know which one's actually correct. But not to make him sound like he's super groundbreaking, this is kind of similar to other Islamic thinkers of the time that, for instance, Jabir's theory had similar references to the amounts of substances. So it's just interesting to note that there were some others along this line.
So whether in this book or another book, Maslama was one of those who really differentiated in between chemistry and alchemy and really underlined genuineness as a science, stressing the magnanimity of scientific persuasion and being distinct from magic and sorcery. So we're talking about he's really got his feet placed here in mathematics and chemistry and not so much in the sorcery and the occult of magic. Furthermore, he emphasized the requirement of the student of chemistry to have a good knowledge of mathematics, to have that foundation, that key foundation, so that his students could adopt a scientific approach based on the experimentation and observation. His statements in the field of chemistry is his most famous assertion that one is claimed to be a chemist should fully be certain that the criteria including reading Euclid's mathematical work, Ptolemy's astronomy, and Aristotle's philosophy, and then mix that all together, and then read Jabir ibn Hayyan, known as Geber.
Right.
We talked about Geber.
We did
before,
a show on
right?
him. Yeah.
Was there also a pseudo Geber by the time?
Yep. There you
there
go.
Was, so we're bringing
there
that back
go.
Into the
yep.
deal. And the Imam Razi, before training his hands on experimentation and his mind on analysis. So there was a process
yeah.
here that he was
we
very
did a,
focused
we did a show,
upon.
We did a show on Al-Razi too. So, in fact, I interviewed Peter Adamson.
Adamson, yeah.
Not that I want to mention him again on our show, but, you know, the Gayat, his other work, is more concentrated with advanced esotericism, namely mostly astrology and talismanic magic. So, and even prophecy, okay? So he kind of considered this advanced level work, occasionally referring to the Rubat as the foundation text. So Rubat being, okay, what you got to learn first, and then when you're ready to move on, the Gayat. Again, could have been somebody else authoring this. So, you know, it's kind of hard to see that this really rational scientific mind would then write about this esoteric stuff. But you could also see it as, okay, that he just wanted to differentiate the two, right? And then write on both things. So, yeah, either way you want to look at it, I couldn't really tell you what actually happened. But basically, the Gayat is the treatise of this kind of ancient as well as medieval scientific theory, but also this Islamic hermetic literature of kind of, you know, philosophical importance, and then back to this pure scientific data ranging from alchemy, astronomy, botany, and others. So there's a mix in this Gayat. So maybe you have to read the really, you know, have a strong scientific foundation to understand this other things. Hard to say. But in the West, the book became known as Picatrix, which, again, we have this Latin translation in the 13th century, and that was also based on an earlier Spanish translation, and both appear to have been produced at the same time in, you know, in court Alfonso X, like we mentioned. This is the most famous of the two books, and an Arabic version was found as late as 1920 by Wilhelm Prince. So there you go. So one person described this book as kind of a simplification of talismanic procedures that were common among alchemists in the medieval age, especially in the pursuit of developing gold from other metals. So really these kind of alchemical talisman things that he kind of maybe codified them and you know, wrote them down in a kind of formalized way. That's at least one person's take on this. But
reports of his work as an astrologer in the royal court of Cordova lacked validity. Well, may not have been a lot of historical truth to it. Moreover, it was the defective inference that resulted in the forecast of the fall of the caliphate. And as a result, his prophecy in the field of astrology, so this all starts kind of coming down around him a little bit here, it was the erroneous perception of commoners in the Muslim world during those periods that associated astronomy with astrology and the magic and the sorcery that came with it.
We've talked about this before that in the Muslim world, this all kind of went together until, was it Al-Razi? Who's really tried to differentiate between one kind of philosophy and another kind of philosophy, namely there's a scientific mathematical basis to one, and, you know, astrology and magic and sorcery go on the other. So Not that they're necessarily false, but that there's a difference between the two.
This is the divergent in the road, right?
Yeah,
here. Exactly. Well, the history books, too, written during these times and subsequently, were not devoid of these statements condemning Al-Majriti and associating his work with necromancy. Therefore, this makes all the more probable for commoners and historians to associate him with working as an astrologer in the courts of the caliphate.
Yeah, so it's almost like he got this kind of, you know, long after his death, he got this reputation of being kind of a mythical, or I should say mystical figure.
You're probably wondering, he probably didn't want that.
Yeah, probably not.
You know?
So, yeah. In retrospect, like, I wouldn't necessarily see him as a mystic at all. I would, like we kind of said, I would, you know, kind of take into account the society that he lived in. So that it was just common practice to see these philosophies mixed, per se. But we clearly see some very scientific experiments going on and acute and, you know, precise descriptions and that kind of thing. There's another kind of similarly false report of his authorship of the Epistles of the Brethren of Purity, which, you know, has been criticized. Yeah, and there was even just false reports of him writing things that he didn't write. And this could come back to the pseudo Al-Majriti, but also even in his lifetime, that some of his contemporaries might have written some other more mystical works that happened in his lifetime but wasn't actually written by him. So the, you know, majority of people in his time in his lifetime kind of spoke in his favor, and he toured Mesopotamia, and that actually, you know, led to the emergence of his works kind of making its way from that way into Europe. So there's other theories that say one of his students, Al-Kirmani, was the person that actually brought the copy during his visit in Mesopotamia. So it's, you know, kind of hard to dissect what really happened and how they made its way to the Middle East from Spain. But yeah, it's possible that he wrote some commentaries on some of these other books, not necessarily authored them himself. You know, he, like we said before, he edited a lot of things. He wrote a lot of things. So it's possible that he had some mystical writings that he just commented on or edited and then got attributed to him later. I think my favorite part of the podcast that we have someone who talked about the conservation of mass some 700-800 years early. So that's what I'm taking out of this.
Definitely a trailblazer.
So there you have it. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter @AlchemyPodcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on Bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.